is the word of the Lord. Would you pray with me? Our God, who is love, and who has shed his love abroad in our hearts by your Spirit, in order that we may reflect your character to one another and to this world. It's to you that we come this morning. We do so as a people so incredibly and deeply loved. And for this, I am grateful. I'm grateful that we come to a sovereign power, a ruler and authority that is infinite, and that in doing so, we come to one who loves so greatly. Father, I pray this morning as we look at this passage that our hearts would just leap. It's like a call in our ears, summoning us to our greatest mission, Lord, to express and to be vessels of divine love. I pray, Lord, that you would please bless our time this morning. It's so good to be here in this passage and with your people, and I pray for your blessings upon us. I pray you'd give me much grace to proclaim your word in a manner that honors Jesus Christ, who has displayed the greatest love for all in laying down his life for his friends. And I ask this in his name. Amen. Well, there's no question this is one of the most beloved passages in all of the Bible, and I'm very happy to be able to come to it this morning. And in doing so, one of the things that I really love about this passage is it's not one of those passages that, you've got to do a lot of like heavy duty exegetical grunt work to understand. You know what I mean? There are some passages where it's kind of like you've really got to like dig, and then it's like, wow, now I understand it. This is different. You don't have to dig to understand it. What you have to do is slow down. Just read it and absorb it. Because it really is incredibly simple what he's saying. Gordon Fee, he's a New Testament theologian, he had this to say about this passage. He says, this is one of the most beloved passages in the New Testament, and for good reason. It is one of Paul's finest moments. Then he says this, indeed, let the interpreter beware, lest too much analysis detract from its sheer power and beauty. In other words, just kind of back off. Don't get too fancy with it. You don't have to get all sophisticated with it, but just appreciate it for what it is. Because in reality, what makes it so beautiful is its simplicity, and that's something that I want to preserve this morning. I don't want to get all complex, but I want to be simple. And in doing so, I think in reading this passage, and if most of you spent any amount of time doing so, you could probably identify the two main points that arise here in this passage. Number one, Paul is speaking about the supremacy of love. That's just obvious. And number two, Paul is setting forth certain qualities of this love. And that right there pretty much just sums up this passage. And those are the points that I want to give our attention to this morning. And so we begin then with this major theme of the supremacy of love. And as we'll see in a moment, that this is really the preeminent theme in this text, is as Paul is wanting to show that there is nothing greater than love. But in doing so, it's important that we do understand a little bit about the context in which this chapter arises. Because if you're reading along in 1 Corinthians, you'll see it almost does. It's like Paul's having this big discussion here about the gifts of the Spirit. Basically, chapters 12 up through chapter 14. And in doing so, he's just off and running about the gifts in chapter 12, and then suddenly he comes to chapter 13, and it's like, now he starts talking about love, and then boom, we get to chapter 14, verse 1, and he immediately starts in on the gifts again. But there's a reason why he does this. You see, the church in Corinth, it was, most of you probably know, it was a pretty chaotic place. It was a messy church. And amongst the many messes that were going on in the church was this massive preoccupation with, as well as a misunderstanding of, the gifts of the Spirit. And so as a result, there was all kinds of division in the body and all kinds of chaos in the body and just a dissension that was going on. And so what Paul does here, and it's really what he's doing in the entire book, is he's striving to help this church grow up to maturity and become more united. That's ultimately his goal in 1 Corinthians. And so he initially does this in chapter 12 by telling them of the importance of all of the gifts. So look, I know that you're saying you're of Paul and you're of Apollos, and we know that these factions are starting and certain people are sort of elevating themselves because of their giftedness. We understand all of that. So what I need to do here in Paul's mind is I need you to step back and realize that every gift is important. And so to emphasize that, what he does is he uses the analogy of the human body. You know, what would a body be if it was all a hand and there was no foot? What would a body be if it was all an eye and there was no ear? What would it be? It would be malformed. It wouldn't function properly. The same is true with the church. Every gift, even the ones that are seemingly unimportant, are important in order for the body to function properly as it should. And this is where he begins. He begins by kind of leveling the playing field, if you will, by saying, every gift is important, and everyone has a gift from the Spirit. And that's where he begins in chapter 12. And then in chapter 14, he then highlights the fact, with that in mind, that yes, every gift is important, but there are certain gifts that are more important. There is an order, a priority. First there's this, then there's this. And so, but it's in that reality that everyone is important that then we can understand and put things in their proper context and proper place as to the fact that some gifts are more important, just as, you know, the brain is more important than the fingernail. Every part is important. That's where he begins and that's where he ends. But nestled between these points, Paul pauses. And he says, but I will show you still a more excellent way. So there's something beyond all of this. There's something that is significantly greater than even the greatest of gifts. And that leads us right into chapter 13, verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And from there, he's off and running. And in doing so, his point is clear. That love is the greatest. And the first thing he alludes to as it being greater than are the gifts. And you'll notice he singles out four gifts in particular as, you know, being representative of all the gifts: tongues, prophecy, knowledge, and the working of miracles. So he says, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. That's all I am. What Paul is saying here is that no matter how great my gift of language is, no matter how spectacular it is, so that even if I'm speaking a language that angels speak, if I don't have love, then I'm just empty noise. That's all I am. And notice, he doesn't say, that's all I'm producing. But instead, you'll notice that he dehumanizes himself. And he says, that's all I am. I am a noisy gong. I am a clanging cymbal. It's not just that I'm producing, you know, empty noise, but that's literally what I have become. The verb is actually in the perfect tense, which sort of helps to emphasize that. It's now who he is. He's nothing. And so tongues, and for that matter, all oratory gifts, they're worthless without love. And as he goes on, we see that the same is also true of prophecy and knowledge and even the working of miracles. In verse 2, he says, if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And so no matter how great my gifts are, no matter how spectacular my gifts are, if I don't have love, then I am nothing. And that's shocking. Because, you know, for our part, we read that and we think, now, you know, come on, Paul, that's a little harsh. I mean, to say you're nothing, I mean, if nothing else, you know, working of miracles, there's a wow factor to that that could be a huge benefit to God's kingdom, isn't there? But unless we're going to accuse Paul of hyperbole, Paul's going to come right back and say, you've got it all wrong. Even if I can move mountains, if I have not love, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. If I don't have love. And I'll tell you, when we see that, when we see how emphatic Paul is here, it tells us that love is immeasurably greater than all of the gifts. And you know, it's something that's really important for us to know. Because it's really easy for us to get swept up and swept away by those who are gifted. You know, we see their gifts and we clamor for them and we fawn over them like a bunch of teenage girls over a boy band. There's just this, oh, did you hear him? And it's just this, like, this, it's just fawning over the gift. And what Paul's saying is that's the wrong thing to fawn over. That's the wrong thing to get enamored with. And not only is it wrong, but it's potentially dangerous. Because, you know, the thing is, gifts can be natural. And gifts can also be counterfeit. So you can have a person who is incredibly charismatic. You know the word for gift, charismata? That's where we get our word charismatic. You can have this charismatic individual, and boy, is he sharp. He really knows his stuff. And if you heard him speak, his oratory gifts, his ability to command an audience and leave us hanging on the edge of their seat and expound to us the things that we long to know, his gifts are absolutely amazing, and you're completely captivated by those gifts. But then underneath, he's mean, he's harsh, he's arrogant, he's greedy, and he's dishonest. And you're fawning over him because he can preach a good sermon. But we follow him. We chase him. Where are they next? I got to get there, wherever he is. Oh, you hear rumors. Oh, but he preaches so well. His gift of tongues and prophecy are amazing. So off to wherever to hear the gift, to chase the gift. And then the person falls, sadly. And we're shocked. We say, how could that have happened? He was such a good teacher. Have any of you ever thought that? Well, it shows how easy it is to be enamored by gifts if you have thought that. Because you're now equating the fact the guy could teach or preach with the fact that he's a good man. And newsflash here, guess what? There's been a lot of good sermons preached by bad men. A lot. A lot. There's been all kinds of men that have stood in pulpits and preached, and they've done so for all the wrong reasons. And they're greedy and they're dishonest. And they're not loving, they're not kind, they're not approachable, but they're harsh, and they're judgmental. And we've all seen it. But they preach a good sermon, and so they get a pass on the things that matter most. You know, I remember one executive pastor telling me that their senior pastor, a man that he worked for, was not a nice man. Not a nice man. It's not the only time I've heard that sort of thing either. And yet thousands were in this church to hear this preacher, because boy, could he preach. Thousands. You know what Paul would say of that man? He's nothing. He's nothing. That's what he'd say of that man. So don't get enamored with gifts. Don't think that because someone can preach a good sermon that that makes that person a good man, because it doesn't. It doesn't. I hope that you never judge me based upon a sermon, based upon a gift or a lack thereof. I hope you never judge Clark based upon a sermon or lack thereof, based upon a gift or lack thereof, because it's shallow. As we'll see, it's childish thinking. That's childish to think that way. So be careful. And interestingly, do you know who I think needs to be extra careful? It's the mature Christians. By mature, I mean those who know and love their Bibles and know and love theology. Because for them, great preaching is what makes them tick. It makes them tick. It's what they cherish, which is a great thing. But the problem is that they cherish it so much that they're easily swept away by the great preachers, by the ones who can take them deeper into that biblical and theological world that they love so much. And so everything is about the quest to find the best preaching. That's the quest. I've got to find the best preaching. And once they find it, man, they lock in. They lock in and they stay locked in. Sometimes even when warning signs begin to appear, they see he's not very loving. They see he's not very kind. They see he's not very patient. They see that he's not very humble. They see that he's not even always very truthful. But boy, is he sharp. And man, can he preach. He's got gifts. They're captivated by them. And so they continue to hang on his every word. And you know what the really ironic thing about it is? It's that in their allegiance to great preaching, they think they have a high standard for the church, when in reality, they've lowered the standard. They've said, that's what matters most. Paul doesn't say that. He says, I, first person, the guy's an apostle. He knows how important the gifts are. But he says if he doesn't have love and he has all these other things, he says, I'm nothing. I am nothing. And he says it because it's not about gifts, but it's about fruit. And the greatest fruit is love. It's the greatest fruit. You know, this is precisely what Jesus warns us about in Matthew chapter 7. He says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them. How? By just how ungifted they are. It's a dead giveaway. You know, the ravenous wolf, they have there no gifts in them, so it's really easy. If they don't have gifts, then they're ravenous wolves. Is that what he says? He says you'll recognize them by their fruits. Because, as he says, every healthy tree, interesting translation, the word that's used, agathon, it's actually a moral word, and it speaks of moral goodness. So I like the translation, every good tree, I guess that is healthy as well, but every good tree bears good fruit, but a diseased tree. The word means rotten, corrupt. A rotten tree, a corrupt tree, it bears bad fruit, evil fruit. So you know the true from the false, not by how gifted an individual is, but you know it by how fruitful he is. And the greatest of all those fruits is love. And this love is greater than any of the gifts. And that's Paul's point here. You know, if you want to read something, and I know there are those of you who like when there is, a recommendation that is thrown out there for reading. If you want to read something that's really good along these lines, read Jonathan Edwards' work, Charity and Its Fruit. It's actually, it's 16 sermons, and they were preached in his church, I think 1738. But throughout this, what it is it's an exposition of 1 Corinthians 13, and it's just absolutely, it's one of his best works. But in his second sermon, it's titled, More Excellent Than the Extraordinary Gifts of the Spirit. And for a good part of this sermon, you know, he's just kind of just going through redemptive history, and he's just talking about the great gifts of the great figures in Scripture. Moses, how he brought the plagues and divided the Red Sea, and what a spectacular thing this was. And David and his ability to write and create songs and poetry and music and so forth. And Elijah and Elijah who raised the dead and cured leprosy and closed off the heavens from rain. and by Daniel and his ability to interpret dreams and interpret visions and how he closed the mouths of lions and escaped from, you know, unharmed from this fiery furnace. And then he goes on into the apostles and speaks of the apostles of Christ and the tremendous gifts that they had, abilities to work miracles and all that they had. And he just goes on and on and on talking about what great privileges these gifts are. And as you're reading it, you're just like, you know, it's just building and building and building. And then he says, though these are great privileges, yet that ordinary influence of the Spirit of God, working the grace of love in the heart, is a far more excellent privilege than any of them. I mean, how many of you, if he said, okay, I'm going to give you the ability to work miracles, or I am going to absolutely fill your heart with love so you are such a loving person? How many of you would say, give me that love? I hope all of us would. I think there's a lot saying, man, miracles would be pretty killer. That would really separate me. Edward says, love in the heart is far more extraordinary. It's exactly what Paul is saying here. It's so much greater. Without love, I am nothing. And so Paul begins by speaking of the supremacy of love over the gifts, but he doesn't stop there. But he goes on to speak of the supremacy of love over generosity and over sacrifice. And notice, it's not just nominal generosity, like, hey, I'll pick up dinner tonight. But he says, if I give away all I have, the verb actually means to divide. And what he's saying is, if I take everything I have and I divide it up and give it all away to the poor, I just give it all away to the poor. If I do that, but have not love, I gain nothing. Same is true with sacrifice. Again, this isn't nominal sacrifice, but this is big time. If I deliver up my body to be burned but have not love, I gain nothing. So if I willingly suffer a martyr's fate, I willingly go to the stake to be burned alive but have not love, profits me nothing. And thus, not only is love supremely greater than the gifts, but it's supremely greater than even the greatest generosity and even the greatest sacrifice. So much so that Paul says, even if I have and do all of that, but don't have love, I gain nothing. There's no profit in it. It's vain. It's worthless. The whole idea is that those don't replace or unseat the supremacy of love. They can't rise above it as though that's greater. And as such, he's saying it's really a false measure of spirituality to look at these other things and say, oh, well, you know, even in your own heart, you don't talk about it with others because that's then unspiritual. But to think about how much you give away. Think about that and find spiritual comfort in that. Comfort as to the grace of God in your life by how much you give or by how much you have sacrificed, going to the mission field, whatever it is. And you find comfort in that as though that's what elevates you spiritually. That's what sort of, you know, makes you a spiritual giant. And, you know, I'll tell you, those things are things that hearing them probably makes some people uncomfortable. Because for some people, and I'd even say for many people, well, just don't raise your hands. I always do this so you think, you know. Hey, whoop, oh, he raised his hand. I got to, whatever he's thinking. But but what's easier, to write a check or to love? A lot of people that would love to just kind of sit off in the silence of their home and listen to a sermon on the radio and so on, and then just write checks and dish them off and not have to love. Not have to roll up their sleeves and really, actually, truly love. That's too much. Happy to write a check. But really? To love, not just in word and tongue, but in deed and truth? That's rough. But they do that. And in doing it, they tell themselves how spiritual they are. Paul says that's nonsense. D.A. Carson, he wrote a book showing the Spirit. It's kind of just a theological exposition of chapters 12 through 14. And in it, he said, "My deeds of philanthropy and my resolute determination to remain loyal to the truth, even in the face of martyrdom, cannot in themselves attest my high spiritual position or the superiority of my experiences with the Holy Spirit. In all of this, if there is no love, I gain nothing." You can't console yourself as to how great of a spiritual person you are by measuring the sacrifices you make or the size of the checks you write. You need love. You need love. And without that, we gain nothing. And so we see the supremacy of love. But in seeing it, we come to our second point and really the question, what then is love? Because this idea, this love, is something that it's just everywhere in the world now, isn't it? Everybody talks about love, and then they threaten with the word hate. And boy, you don't want that label on you. But their idea of love is very, very different from the Bible's idea of love. You see, according to the world, you know, what do you think when you hear the world speak of love? I mean, for me, what I think of every time I hear the world speak of love is that you must affirm everything except anything that doesn't affirm everything. I mean, that's pretty much right. You know, so long as you're not hurting anybody. So long as you're not hurting, by hurting, you know, abusing or, you know, suppressing things like that. But it really is affirming everything except anything that doesn't affirm everything. And that's why Christians are viewed as being unloving. Because we don't affirm everything. We don't say that, sure, anything goes, but we, in accordance with God's word, believe that there are things that are morally wrong. We're just believing what the Bible tells us. And so because of that, we are unloving. And this is what, it's what we're up against, and it's not easy. I mean, one of the worst things to be accused of in society today, certainly in many people's mind, is hate. And so there's this constant bullying that goes on. Bullying, that if you don't jump on board and affirm everything that those over there want to affirm, well, then you hate and you are not loving. And that's why, really, a passage like this is so important, because it not only sets us straight as far as just prioritizing our values and seeing love as supreme. And I think that's important for us, because one of the things to do, you know, I mean, typically there's like the reaction and the overreaction. And so you have everyone over here saying love, love, love. But because their idea of love is something that you so do not see as being truly biblical love, we then discard love and we just go over here. And so love is not something that, it's not something that we should be the ones exalting love. If we believe like Paul, if we believe like Christ, we should be the ones exalting love. And then in exalting it, expressing it rightly. What is it really? Well, that's what Paul does here. He highlights some of its greatest qualities. And I'll tell you, Edwards did 16 sermons on this chapter. I'm doing one. It wouldn't be hard to do 16. So I wish I could take more time to go through these qualities, but I just want to present them to you and have you kind of think about them. And so we find these qualities in verses 4 through 7, and at the top of his list is a pair of positive qualities. He goes a couple of positive, and he has a bunch of negatives, and then he ends with four more positives. But here, he begins with a couple of positive qualities. He says that love is patient and kind. Now, this word patient, I think we all have an idea of what patient to be patient is. It's, in one sense, it's a willingness to wait a long time for something. You know, that's certainly, you know, patience. It's enduring suffering without giving in. But there's also, in this word patience, is there is a willingness to not strike back, to not retaliate. And so you think about it, for example, you know, I mean, take the proverbial, you know, stuck in traffic after a long day at work. And there you are, you're stuck in traffic, and you're irritated because you're stuck in traffic. So what do? I retaliate by yelling at the guy in front of me. As though that one car that cut in front of me, if he didn't, I'd get home 30 minutes quicker, you know? And the same thing happens in relationships. You get irritated by something that your husband or wife or kids or parents or the person next to you in church says or does, whatever. But rather than absorbing it, rather than enduring it, you retaliate. And you retaliate in a number of ways. Doesn't mean you get in a fight. I mean, you know, you can blow up or clam up. You can rush in or you can pull back, and there's everything in between, but there is a retaliation for it. Patience doesn't do that. Patience, it doesn't retaliate, doesn't strike back. That's what Paul says. He says love doesn't do that. Love isn't, you could think of it, isn't short-tempered. It's not short-tempered. So that's first. Along with this, Paul says love is kind. And that's one I think if any of us were writing a list as to qualities of love that we would probably put up or near the top as well. Love is kind. It's that quality of being warm and pleasant, considerate, caring. That's kindness. It's something that when you encounter it, you immediately know it. Kindness is something that it's like magnetic. It's one of the most beautiful qualities to find in someone. Kindness. And this, of course, is one of the qualities that's used to describe the Lord. You know, Luke 6, Jesus is telling his disciples to love their enemies and in doing so to be like our Father in heaven, whom he describes as being kind to the ungrateful and evil. God is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. He's benevolent towards them. He's charitable towards them, even when they don't want anything to do with him. That's what Jesus calls us to be. Moreover, Paul says that's ultimately what brings those who are opposed to God to him. He says it's the kindness of God that leads them to repentance. And so, within biblical love, the qualities to it, we see it's patient. It's not, you know, short-tempered, but it's patient and it's kind. And from here, Paul lists off a list of negatives, telling us what love does not do. It does not envy, meaning it doesn't get jealous when other people succeed. It's not, you know, saying, oh, why wasn't that me? It doesn't do that. It doesn't boast. I like, it's fun to go through other translations and look at how they translate this. The King James Version translate this as, it doesn't parade itself. Love doesn't do that. It's not like, you know, hey, look at me, you know, and it's just like, you're going to have a parade for yourself and, you know, look how great I am. Along with this, love is not arrogant. It's not puffed up. It's not seeking to exalt itself at the expense of others. You know, when somebody, they have to step on others, make them lower in order to appear bigger themselves. Love doesn't do that. Love is not rude. I was thinking about this as, should I say it? Yeah. Well, it doesn't behave unbecomingly or disgracefully, and I'll just say I was thinking of the Women's March. You know? I mean, remember some of the signs and everything, the vulgarity, and I just thought, are you kidding? It also does not insist on its own way. It doesn't seek its own. It naturally, you know, inclines one to think of and put others before themselves. Love's not irritable, so it's not easily provoked. It doesn't have a short fuse. Love is also not resentful, so it doesn't hold a grudge. Again, the NIV says it keeps no record of wrongs. So love is, it's not going to say you always or you never. It doesn't keep that kind of list. Love does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. So it doesn't rejoice when they see, you know, the misfortunes and the sins of others, but it delights any time the truth is advanced. And so there's this list of negatives that he says what love is not. And with that, he then concludes with these four positives, saying love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. So love always presses on, and it always hopes for the best. And so you think about these qualities, the positive qualities and the negative qualities, and then you think about the love that is, you know, proposed by the world. And you see how different it is. And then you think about how this is what's to characterize us. Because one of the kind of fun exercises to do, I think I even wrote it on the children's worksheet, is to replace the word love in verses 4 through 7 with the name Jesus. Because in doing so, you get a picture of what Christ is really like. And in seeing that picture, we then get kind of like a, you know, it becomes a visual for us. And we then see what we are called to be like as well. And so Paul says, to sum it up, love never ends. And that's ultimately why love is the greatest. Because as he says, prophecies and tongues and knowledge and all of these gifts, they're all going to pass away. And they will so when the perfect comes, which is a reference to the second coming of Christ. There's a whole discussion that can be made about that. But clearly, this is what the reference is to. It's to when Christ himself returns. And thus what he's saying is that love will continue beyond just this age. It continues for all of eternity. And this is where Edwards concludes his thing in this, probably the highlight of that entire work, where he has this sermon, Love, Heaven, a World of Love. And just talking about how love is what continues to just carry on through all of eternity as we are now shaped and love is completely perfected in us. That's what we are ultimately moving towards. It's towards having love perfected in us. And so the gifts are temporary, but love is forever. As in that day when we're perfected, I mean all of the conflicting, self-serving, self-exalting, stingy, angry, mean, hateful elements anywhere within us, they're all going to be just dissolved away, swallowed up by perfect love. So knowing this, we need to place supreme value on love. God is love. The fruit of the Spirit is love. The whole of God's law is summed up in love. His people are known by their love. The one who loves has fulfilled the law. I mean, love from beginning to end throughout the Bible is clearly set forth as being the greatest. So there is absolutely nothing more godlike and more important for the Christian to possess and give than love. As Edwards says, all that is saving and distinguishing in Christianity does radically consist and is summarily comprehended in love. Meaning Christianity is what it is because of love. It's what makes Christianity Christianity. It's love. It's that reality. And that's the way we need to think. Because as the analogy shows in verse 11, to think otherwise is to think like a child. It's to think in a spiritually immature way. And that's so ironic because so often we think of these other things as being associated with maturity. We think of gifts and of giving and of sacrifice, and we think, wow, maturity. But what Paul's saying is that's the way a child thinks. Because, you know, kids are really easy to impress, especially with gifts. I mean, kids are, you dazzle a kid with gifts. It's childish. And thus Paul says, when I became a man, when I grew up, I started thinking differently, and I gave up childish ways. I stopped thinking that there were other things that were greater and more important. And I realized the supremacy of love. And that's what matters most. And this morning, I want you all to realize that. As those who are so deeply loved by a God of love, that the greatest mark upon your life as a Christian is love. It's how the world will know you and know you are one of His. You will have this love for one another, and you will make this priority. And this is something that on this day, as Clark is going to be ordained here, it's something that I wanted to share not just with you, but also specifically with Clark. And the reason why is because as a minister, People will often comment on your gifts. That's just what they do. They comment on your gifts. And so it's easy for you to make that the means by which you evaluate yourself. That becomes the end all. That becomes the be all. I preached a good sermon. They liked the sermon. And now you've kind of done your job. And it's so easy to fall into that mentality and that trap as a pastor, because gifts are what are so often responded to. And what I would say to you is that never, don't ever let that define who you are. Your giftedness or your lack thereof, the fact that your gift is better than that person's, or your gift isn't as great as that person's, or whatever it is, if whoever it is that occupies this position doesn't have love, we're nothing. We're nothing. And it's important for us to know. For you as a congregation, it's so important to hold this church to a high standard by not just settling for good preaching. Demand more. Demand love. Because love is the greatest. And so, as Paul says in chapter 14, verse 1, pursue love. Pursue it. Chase it. Drive after it. And take hold of it. Because in doing so, you will shine brightly for your God, who is a God of love and has loved you and loved all of his people so much that he gave his own son for us. I mean, how can you preach that and not have love? How can you preach? Love lies at the very center of the gospel that we proclaim. It's at the dead center. Again, I've been reading a lot of Edwards, and he makes this point again and again and again as well, but it's at the dead center. Love is. And to stand and preach his gospel, there must be love. Let's pray.